Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Katherine Widener. Widener is a professor and chair in the Department of Theater Arts at Ithaca College. She holds a BFA in acting from Ithaca College and an MFA in directing from the University of Minnesota. In addition to teaching, she also works as an actor and a professional director. She has worked in many theaters around the country, including the Hangar Theater, the Nebraska Repertory Theater, the Kennedy Center, Center Stage in Baltimore, and La Jolla Playhouse in California. She is a member of Actors Equity Association and the Society of Stage Directors and Choreographers. And welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tish. It's great to be here.
Yeah. Now, I want you to tell me how you got interested in doing theater originally, really.
Oh, well, you know, it's a great story of public education. One of the things we did when we were probably sophomores in high school in my little small town in Illinois where I grew up was we went to college theater productions as part of our English class. You know, we would go to a 2 o'clock or a 10 a.m. matinee, and I think I must have been a sophomore, and we went to see Arthur Miller's The Crucible at McMurray College in Jacksonville, Illinois, this tiny little, you know, probably 400 students. But it was the most extraordinary thing I'd ever seen. You know, I don't think I'd ever been to a play before, you know, besides sort of skits in school.
Yeah, yeah.
But I remember sort of sitting there and going, can you do this as your major? Like, wait a minute. So I just thought, obviously, the theater completely transported me.
Yes.
But that was sort of what started it. I was inspired by
just that
a great production by an educator who gives this experience an opportunity to their students. And then it becomes an opportunity for us, you know, kids in this public school in Central Illinois to see this incredible work of American playwriting, which I'd never seen before.
It illuminates you. I know. I've seen theater do that to people. I really have.
I was sort of glued to I had no idea what was going to happen. We didn't read the play in advance. You know, it wasn't like being dragged to Romeo and Juliet or something. You know, it was like we were going to see this play. I didn't know what it was about, and it was fascinating, and I just didn't understand how it all worked. And from there, it was that's it.
So what was your next step, though? Were you trying out for plays in the community, or did you start doing it in school?
Well, my big brother was in the high school musicals, and I wanted to be like him, so I wanted to try out for the school plays. And we didn't have school plays at middle school. It was something only the high school had. So by the time I got to be in high school, I certainly did that because I'd seen my brother in high school plays. I was in the band as well, so every summer we'd go to, you know, a band camp somewhere, and I said I wanted to go to a theater camp or whatever. Uh-huh. We didn't have very much money, obviously, but I found this great place at Terre Haute, Indiana, Indiana State University, and they had a summer program for high school juniors, which now, of course, every college has a summer program for high school juniors because it's a great recruitment tool. And what's really interesting is I was at that summer theater working as a little kid, you know, taking classes all day, and we were living in the dorms, and we were, you know, 15, 16 years old, and they had a professional summer theater company. And I think it was called, like, Indiana State Rep or something. Mm. But one of the professional equity actors was Larry Hirshhorn,
who had
this giant Ithaca 77 or whatever sweatshirt on. And there was a day when the professional actors came and talked to us teenagers. But I said, what's Ithaca? And he said, Ithaca College. It's BFA in acting. It's where you should go to college if you want to be in theater. And I mean, to me, he was, you know, a rock star, Hirshhorn. And I sent away a postcard. Those were the days when, you know, you sent away a postcard and a week later you'd get a brochure, and you'd sit and look at it for 3 days. And I decided to apply, and I didn't tell my parents. And they wanted me to apply to, you know, University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana, and, you know, Western Illinois, and all those, cheap local places. And I said, no, I want to go to Ithaca College. And I drove with my dad in a pickup truck, and we drove on a Friday night. We drove all day Friday. My audition was at 11 o'clock or 9 o'clock in the morning up at campus, and we turned right around and drove back. We didn't even stay in a hotel. We couldn't afford a hotel. I just had a pillow in the front cab of my dad's pickup truck, and he probably napped and smoked a cigarette while I was doing my audition, and we just turned around and drove back. And when I came back, when I got accepted, I came the next year. Larry had graduated, so I already knew this alum. And now, of course, Larry and I are the best of friends.
Oh,
you know,
I'll bet.
He's a Tony Award-winning producer, but I knew him. He's the reason that I came to Ithaca College. It's because a professional student who had just graduated already had a professional gig and was working at this, you know, rep company in Indiana. He did two plays, a musical, and, you know, he was a working actor.
Yeah.
And he had this impact on this 15-year-old girl from the sticks, you know, and here I am.
And it took.
Yeah.
You know what I'm always interested in? I love theater myself. I did theater for a time.
Yeah.
How did you segue into directing? Because you're a very serious director.
Well, thank you. I segued into directing because it was a requirement in most acting programs that you have to take what's called, you know, directing one. And you sort of have to take it to understand there's a bigger picture than just your character. So I took directing one from my professor, Dr. Richard Clark, who the Clark Theater is named after. He was the greatest directing professor I've ever had. And it changed my life. It improved my acting, certainly, because I stopped thinking about myself and started realizing there was a story to be told. And I realized that's really what I was meant to do, was be a director. But after taking directing one, I decided to take directing two, which is more advanced. You'd have to direct, you know, a part of a play and whatever. And then I applied for the senior directing projects, which they allow very few students to do, but they jury you, you know, you decide, they decide. And so I got to direct a one-act play. And then I went into the acting business for 2 years, moved to Chicago, and started directing sort of scrappy little, you know, late nights here and stage readings here. And I realized I needed real training. So I went and got an MFA in directing at University of Minnesota, where I ended up working at the Guthrie. Wow. As an intern.
God, that's amazing.
I know. I was 27 years old. I went to my director of graduate studies and I said, how do I get in at the Guthrie? And he said, oh, they're not hiring any directing interns, but they do need a dramaturgy intern. And I said, what's dramaturgy? And he said, oh. So I said, if I do the dramaturgy internship this semester, maybe I could do a directing internship next semester. And they needed someone so badly that they agreed. So they sort of gave me this thing nobody wanted, which was to be the dramaturgy intern for Glass Menagerie, where I worked with one of the greatest dramaturgs of all time, Mark Bly, who has worked for the Guthrie for years. So he was my mentor. So I sort of say I'm a director, but I was raised by dramaturgs. You know how people are raised by wolves. I was raised by dramaturgs. So I learned sort of from the inside to be a critic, but a critic on the team. And that's really what a dramaturg is sort of an in-house critic to look at what's happening and make sure that it's all in line with what the vision is, which was great training to be a director.
You know what? It sounds like you found the yellow brick road to the theater. No, seriously. Well, but you know what I want to ask you, too? Because I haven't known that many people who are serious directors who also act, seriously act as well. Tell us about the segue between those two. Do you think that you can be a good director without knowing a little bit about the art of acting?
Well, I think most directors, it seems, come from somewhere. They come from performing. They come from choreography. They come from something where they've realized to step out of being a part of it and observe and shape has a dynamic that's very different from the sort of swinging the hammer that you do as an actor.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think that, A, becoming a director or becoming aware of directing in a more profound way and the tools of directing, especially analysis and physical movement and style, made me such a better actor. And I also think as an actor, I love it when I get hired as an actor because I don't have to be responsible for everything.
Exactly.
I get to do my, it's like being a sous chef. You know, I'm not responsible for the presentation and I'm not responsible for this, but I have this piece of it that I can make the best that I can. And that's all I can do. Yeah. So I love that. I'm also the youngest, you know, sibling. So I just want to do what I can do. I don't want to. There are times when I don't want to be in charge, but I love when I'm a director that I'm able to say, well, this is the direction we want to go in. So I think the two really feed each other. It's like saying you're a chef, but do you cook it? You know, do you cook your own? Yeah. Do you like to eat?
But it also helps you work with actors. Because I mean, when I did theater, there were a lot, you know, we were amateurs, you know, small playhouses.
We all are. We all are amateurs.
But the thing is, a lot of the directors were amateurs so much that they had never really done any acting. And they had no sympathy for what the actors were struggling through and trying to create a character and what's real. And so I think it's very interesting. To have both.
I think a director has to understand what it means to put yourself out there as an actor and to be vulnerable. And so I think that sort of old school of directors just directing is not as effective as someone who understands what the actor's process is. Usually what I'll say to an actor that I haven't worked with before, often I work with actors that I know them because they're my former students or I've cast them in a production before. So sometimes I'll be in Maine where I often direct and I'll have three or four actors that have worked with me before, and I'll say to the other actors, I want to know how I can best work with you. Tell me what you need. And they just look at me like, really? And I go, yeah, are you the kind of person who wants, you know, a lot of little notes? Do you want stuff early? Are you a person that brings a lot to the table? Or do you need someone to sort of challenge and and let you know what direction, you know, I want. I mean, I'm always interested in the actor's ideas, but some people have their own process. So it's like, tell me about your process.
Yeah.
How can we best work together?
Oh, that's good. I mean, that's a special need for a director to be confident like that.
Yeah.
And to trust the people that you're working with. Now, do you have a special philosophy around directing or techniques that you use particularly?
Well, I would say for me, my philosophy is the text is the lead. That if I find it in the text, then it's true, right? Mm. Now, it may be that the narrator is unreliable, you know, and that it's Iago talking, you know, but I love finding the events and I love finding what we call the given circumstances. So if I'm reading a play for the first time, my rule is nothing in my hands. No pencil, no highlighter, no notebook. I just read the play and I read it aloud. Because
that makes
the
sense.
Play is actually meant to be heard. But I've learned that if I read aloud, I'm not only using my eyes and my brain to read the play for the first time, but I'm actually hearing it through my ears and I'm saying it with my speech. So it involves all four of the senses that could be involved without the sense of touch, which is, for me, my pen to my paper, which is my brain starting to process or transpose or transfer. And I try to stop myself from doing that until it's like when you were a kid and used to get a new album. You just want to listen to the whole album.
Yeah, yeah.
But when you just know one song, you just listen to the same song over and over. So I like to listen to the whole album. I like to really just let myself read the play aloud. And if I get stuck, I don't go back to the table. I don't go back to the cast list and figure out who's who. Like, oh, I didn't get that. Oh, I don't know who that is. Oh, I don't know who Mary is. Oh, I don't know what he's doing.
Yeah.
You know, I'll just go, huh, I'm confused. But I don't try to solve my problems, and I don't try to be a director while I'm reading a play. That's my number one technique, and that's not even
that's
a technique.
Great. That's
really
great. I mean, it also gives the weight to the writer's intention.
Yeah.
And some people just don't do that. They want to know how they're supposed to move. Or even some bad actors I've worked with who know how to show off best.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You are a great lover of Shakespeare's work, obviously. Now, to tell us why and how do you create Shakespeare productions that really can take the imaginations of people in the modern times?
Well, that's the key with doing Shakespeare, is finding the relevance and making sure that the production resonates with the time. And that's important. Sometimes when you get a gig as a director, especially if it's at a Shakespeare festival, right?
Yeah.
They'll say to you, the artistic director will say, Catherine, we want you to do Taming of the Shrew. Because, of course, they want a woman director, first of all. They don't want a man doing Taming of the Shrew. So you know that you're getting chosen because of that, which is fine. But they'll say, this has to be the period production of the season. The subscribers get very upset if they don't see Elizabethan clothes once. You know, they say, oh, we're doing Julius Caesar, but it's in modern dress, or we're doing Much Ado About Nothing, but we're setting it in the 50s. So this has to be the period production. So sometimes I get that, and I go, okay, great, that's the lens I have to put on.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Catherine Widener. She is a professor and chair in the Department of Theater Arts at Ithaca College. She is also a professional director and actor. Now, do you want to, let's expound on the Shakespeare, because
sure.
A lot of people think, oh, God, Shakespeare,
I know.
It's the ancient times.
Right.
But so much of the production endeavors I've seen are bringing it right into the 20th and 21st century.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean?
Yep.
How do you do that, though? I mean, and do you still use the old language?
Oh, of course. That's what it's meant to be. I mean, that's like saying let's transfer Mozart into, you know, rock music, which would be an interesting experiment, but that's not what I'm here to do. I'm here to find a way that you actually listen to the play and realize, oh, it doesn't even sound different. The language sounds so contemporary, and it's because it was contemporary. You know, Claire Gleitman in our English department says every play was new once, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So there was a time when The Merchant of Venice was exactly what's happening today. You know, it's the Angels in America of today.
Yeah.
It's a reflection of the hatred or the problems or the challenges or the romantic, any zeitgeist of the time is reflected in the plays that are written. So finding a way to sustain that over time it's not about finding a concept. I call that the C word. I don't use the word concept. I just find our sort of viewpoint, the way that the lens points on the world. And I'll decide from what I get from the reading, what I think the play is about and what my emotional response is, but also what I start to imagine in terms of its what it has to say today. And I'll work with my designers, but I don't impose a time right away. for example, when I did Two Gentlemen of Verona, or recently I did Merry Wives of Windsor, we thought those kinds of plays that are about the women have to do what the parents say, you need sort of a father knows best time. So I said, great, let's set it in the 50s and let's make it in a soda shop. And, you know, let's have it happen that, you know, instead of traveling from Verona to Milan, they're going to go from Verona, New Jersey to Milan, Maine. You know, let's transport them, because that's what it's about, is transporting to a new place. So we'll figure out ways to make it relevant, but it never becomes about the setting. It's never that you're setting Julius Caesar in El Salvador. It's just you're saying, what is it about El Salvador right now that serves us? It's there's Contras and there's a person in power and everyone fears that person, and then we're funding the Contras. You know, like, there's so many things that apply, but it's not about El Salvador. It's about people not trusting someone who's in power, deciding to kill them, and then realizing after they've been assassinated that actually what they were doing was for the good of everyone. You know, so you sort of unearth what that play is. Or Hamlet, you know, figuring out what Hamlet actually is about, right? Or why the story is still necessary and relevant. And then working to develop a physical language about it and saying, this is what it's going to be. It's going to be very abstract. We're not going to have a castle, you know? Or, you know, what do we really need to tell the story? It's not about, you know, we used to say, you know, period, schmeriad, no funny pants, you know? who cares what period is? What's important is these are young people that are struggling with something and their parents are getting in their way. How is that not relevant today? Those are the plays Shakespeare wrote. He wrote domestic plays, and he wrote plays about sort of big issues, but the whole world is in his plays, and that's what makes them relevant.
Oh, it is.
Yep.
And do you think a good director of Shakespeare's plays has to be kind of a political scientist, too?
Oh.
You know, aware of the cultural...
I love that. I think they can be a political scientist exploring what were the politics at that moment that generated Othello? You know, what are the politics that generated Julius Caesar? But I also think you think about what's happening today and think, boy, this would be a great time to do something. You know, during the election is when they did Julius Caesar in New York, you know, in the park in New York. So I think there's always a time to think about how so many of his stories are driven by women characters.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, at a time when women weren't allowed on stage until the French companies showed up and they went, oh, look, they've got women on stage. You know, like suddenly it became okay to have women on stage. So he was always putting that female experience at the forefront of his work. And I think, gosh, if that's not relevant today, I don't know what is.
Yeah. But he must have known women weren't allowed to be on the stage when he was writing all these great
characters.
But
he still wrote for their experience.
Absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
Isn't it? Oh,
yep.
God.
He was an advocate for understanding their experience and writing scenes between two women. You know, you just had not really seen that before.
Yeah. And now we see it all the time in all of our cultures. Ingmar Bergman and some of the people who've delved into that.
But there's a rule now. It's called the Bechdel test. Do you know about the Bechdel test?
No.
Alison Bechdel. It's are two women in a movie talking about something other than men? Then it passes the Bechdel test. So it's like many of his plays pass the Bechdel test.
Yeah. Now, I'm interested in this because you worked as a voice and text coach. To tell us what that means, working on voice in regard to, what, accents?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Sometimes accents is more a dialect coach. So I could certainly coach a dialect or two if you asked me to. But mostly when I'm hired as a voice and text coach, it's because the director is going to focus on the action, but there's probably some very complex language. Or it might be a show, if I'm a voice and text coach for a Molière verse play that's in rhyming couplets or something, I'm going to work with those actors specifically on how to heighten that text without drawing attention to it as text, so that I'm working on it on a level that's sort of above and beyond what you would normally say, you need to go home and learn your lines. Yeah. You actually have to sort of unpack your lines, and you have to paraphrase what your lines mean.
Also learning the subtleties.
Yes.
Don't you think? I mean, that's part of it.
Yep. Operative structure, to make sure that you're using operative words so that the ideas are conveyed. I mean, we use operative words all the time. It's how we communicate what we mean.
We
put emphasis on certain words, but you don't want to sound like a sportscaster. You know, you don't want to sound like you're emphasizing them in a fake way, or like some, you know, some radio announcers who do things very properly.
Yeah.
And it's not authentic.
Those weird deep voices.
Yes, exactly. Opportunity, Twitter. You know, it's like it's Twitter. That's the way you say it. It's Twitter. You know, so you sort of look at how someone draws attention to text or speech as an actor, and then you sort of bring it to a level where it sounds like what we call the idiolect, which is the way this person speaks. Wow. How this actor speaks and how it's differentiated from the way that character speaks or the rest of the characters in the play talk.
Yeah.
So idiolect is this is the way I talk.
Yeah.
And it's a product of all the places that I've been and all the things that I've learned. But a voice and text coach will come in and say, let's start at the top of that speech. Let's go there. And we'd just be sitting at music stands like this.
Yeah.
And they'd just say a line and I'd say, great, go back. Let's do it again. What's the image? And they'll say, oh, I'm going to heighten this or this. Now is the winter of our discontent made glorious summer by the sun of York.
Yeah,
instead of going, now is the winter of our discontent. You know, that's the last thing you want is for them to say, oh, this is iambic pentameter. I'm going to make it sound like it has a rhythm. Nobody wants to see that show.
Well, yeah, I know. And theater is just like that anyway. People want realism from theater, whatever the language used.
Yeah. And that's what a voice and text coach helps bring that out. And then they also help when you're in the space to make sure that vocally everything is reaching row P. You know, everything is reaching the balcony, that the voice is up, out, supported, and healthy. Because you're going to have to do it 8 times a week. So it's making sure that you're helping them in a vocal way. I mean, your voice is part of your body. So it's really about making sure the actors are connected in that way.
And authenticity is a great part of good acting, as far as I'm concerned, right?
Right.
And even if you're using Shakespearean language.
Right. So how do you do authenticity in an 800-seat theater? Because you have to produce vocal energy that that supports the space, but you have to have the authenticity that makes you feel, whether you're in the front row or the back row, that you're right there with them.
Yeah.
So that's the challenge of the vocal coach, is making sure that you're not sitting there watching someone yell. Right?
We have done that, all of us.
Right. Well, and I say all the time, this isn't about projection. It's about audibility. It's about being able to be heard and understood. It's not about talking loud.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I remember hearing that from a drama teacher.
Yeah.
That's very, very interesting. Now, I've been wondering about theater people in regard to this issue. Has the digital age changed your direction in producing plays or teaching?
Well, I mean, it's certainly a tool. I know that now people use their phones or their tablets as resources when they're working on plays. There are apps you can use to run your lines. You know, you read your lines into an app and it reads them back to you and pauses and, you know, just like learning a language, like the way language has changed, learning a language has changed because of digital. Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
Or Rosetta Stone, things like that. So I love those things, that the tools that it's given us. But I also think that, I mean, the other day I was at a production at school and, you know, there's always an announcement that says, please turn off your devices and no texting during the show. And you look around because you can see the ghosts, you know, you can see everybody's screens lit up.
Uh-huh.
And I saw a couple of people that they didn't turn it off. They just hid it, like in their lap, so that they could continue to check their text during the show.
Wow.
So I think that's something that I just wish would stop.
Yeah.
You know, I wish that people would trust that it's okay to be present in a theater or a movie even for 2 hours and that it's okay. But they feel it vibrate or they have to check in. So the sort of FOMO, you know,
it's like a security blanket in some ways, isn't it?
Yeah, we had a sort of a pre-show announcement that said, put away your FOMO, you know, just put it away, put away your phone and your FOMO. But it's really hard for people to let go that they're going to miss out on something. And I think they're not missing out. They're in on something, but they just can't trust. I don't mean they, like they. They're a problem. But I wish that the digital community understood that there's a value to turning it off and putting it down and tuning in. You know, the people that bring their phones to meetings or that have their phones with them all the time, or I see people walking on the streets, they have them in their hands.
Oh, I know. But do actors do that too? I would think somebody would be really fanatic about, oh, I got to get this note down on my tablet.
Oh, that's fine. That's fine. But they often
if they're not listening because of that? That's what I would think would be a difficult.
Well, usually what I find is they end up bringing their phone on stage, or as soon as they get off stage, they go to their phone, which means you're going out of the play. And you come backstage and there might be a crew person or someone sitting there playing a game, and I understand they're bored. You know, we used to do crossword puzzles, you know, before there were phones.
Yeah.
We did our crossword puzzles. We still missed a cue now and then. But I think what it does is it creates a distraction. And so when an actor will say to me, I'm writing my notes on my phone, I say, great, thanks for telling me. So when I give them a note, they'll listen to my note, and then they'll take a moment and type it in while I'm talking to the next person.
Yeah.
But they never, I think most actors know not to just sit there and be on your phone.
Oh, yeah. Just listen and not even be aware of what's happening.
Well, valuing the person that's with you.
Yes, and the present moment, like you said before.
Yeah. What a great question.
Well, why do you think theater still captures the imagination of 21st century people? I mean, really, I mean, it's so fast moving, and we're talking about digital, you know, phones and tablets that everybody's preoccupied with. Well, what is it?
Well, now I think partially because of what you just said, I think there's so few things now in life where you feel like you're in the room and you have an impact. I mean, if you see a show at the Kitchen Theater, you are three rows from the stage. Your response, right? I'm a verbal responder at shows, right? If you ever, if we're ever in an audience together, you'll hear me going, I'm very verbal, but I love it because that you actually have an impact on the performance. When you're in a movie, you can press pause and go to the bathroom.
And which people do all the time.
Yeah, so I feel like there's something about the fact that it's now not so common to feel like you're in the presence of people. We've begun to let go of some of the etiquette. I'm shocked sometimes when I go to the theater or, you know, I work at the Hangar. I love the Hangar. There's someone in the front row just opens up their water bottle and starts to drink.
Oh, yeah.
And you just go, you're practically on stage. So I love the fact that the audience has an impact. And I think that that's something that helps keep us connected. And obviously with dance or with musicals or something, there are things that are just so imaginative and alive on stage that you're transported and you're transported, but you're in the room where it's happening.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I don't think that's ever going to change. I just think people get used to not being at the theater anymore. Yeah. So we have to keep it alive.
Yeah, we do. And then theater is such a magic and affecting art.
Yeah.
You know, it's unlike anything else.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we are almost out of time. Can you tell me really quickly what play you've always wanted to direct?
Oh, well, I mean, I have always wanted to direct or be in, right? Right? There's things I love. I love the play Waiting for Godot.
Ah.
I have directed it at a very small college with people that were not actors. They were, you know, college students. I mean, they were actors in my production. And we used an Indonesian gamelan because we had one, you know.
Wow.
But I'd love to be able to do a professional production of Waiting for Godot. I'd also love to do Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf.
That's one of my favorite
it's
plays.
It's an incredible play.
Yes.
And if it were Shakespeare, I've never done Hamlet. And I've never done The Winter's Tale, which is really one of my favorite plays. Not very popular or well-known, not a lot of title recognition. But, you know, I usually say my favorite play is whatever one I'm working on right now.
Yes.
But I have so many shows that I'm interested in doing and plays I'm interested in exploring. So
this is what's going to happen in the future, Catherine.
I hope so.
Can you give some contact information how people can get in touch with you?
Sure. I mean, I'm at Ithaca College, so it's easy to go to our department website, ithaca.edu/theater, and you can check out the theater arts department, and my contact information is there. We love people to come to our shows and see what our students are doing. It's all of tomorrow's theater artists, designers, managers, stage managers, dramaturgs, playwrights, actors, everyone is working. Yeah. So I encourage people to come and see the theater that we make.
And become part of the theater family, which I find an incredible part of theater.
Yeah, and to go to the Kitchen and go to the Cherry and Civic Ensemble and the Hangar and Cortland Rep and Merry-Go-Round. I mean, there's so much great theater in this area.
Yeah,
I just think every weekend there's something that I'm going to because, not because I have to, but because I think, well, I want to see that. And nobody else is doing work like that. And all of our companies in town are so distinctive. And I think it's wonderful to get to know them as sort of we're part of their community.
Yeah. Well, Catherine Widener, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a great pleasure talking to you.
Thank you, Tish. Thanks for having me on the show.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.